Welcome to the Group Home Riches Podcast. If you have the desire to be your own boss, create your own schedule, and become financially free while at the same time helping people in need, then you've come to the right place. At GroupHomeRiches.com, we teach people exactly like yourself how to get started in the group home business. And on this podcast, you're going to hear their stories firsthand.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Group Home Riches Podcast. A couple of weeks ago, we did a live webinar with Andy just talking about the future of real estate and kind of learning about his career and, you know, how to take advantage of the upcoming, in our opinion, there's going to be a downturn. And we had a very informative guest just pop in the chat. She was talking about working with HUD and shared vouchers, which me and Andy hadn't even heard about. So we had a ton of questions for her. We found out that she actually has a very promising and blossoming career. So we are excited to have her on, learn about her story, as well as the HUD shared vouchers and everything like that. Gladys, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And we also have joining us, I know he's running around in the airport right now, but we have Gladys's business partner as well. Kevin, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Before we kind of get into the details and like the stuff that we were talking about the webinar, Gladys, why don't you just tell us a little bit background information? Tell us, what were you doing before you found us? And what made you want to get into this business model in the first place?
So before I found you, a traditional, what you call a tiger mom, I just believed going to school almost endlessly is the way to, you know, get a good job, a good W-2 job. And I pretty much encouraged my kids to do the same thing. So after I finished very many degrees, you don't want to really know how many degrees I have. Yeah. So after I finished, I got a W-2 job and I really focused on raising my kids and I channeled them in that direction. But I was still struggling, you know, I was struggling. So anyway, just like any other family, we wanted to get a primary home. So I began riding around in Nashville looking for a primary home. And I noticed that actually the houses which are on the market were pretty a bit expensive to what we can afford. So we thought we could just ride around and make our offers as we go, maybe for sale by owner. And like enough, when I was driving around, I actually noticed that there was a house which was on sale for by owner. So I decided, oh, I'm going to give a shot, ask the owner, how much is it? Then he told me $80,000. And an investor was bringing a contract the next day. So they are waiting for the investor. Then I asked them, what about if we offered you $90,000? Then they said, oh, you can? I'm like, yeah. Because what I had noticed is that the houses on the market on Redfin were actually at about $120,000, $130,000. So I knew this was really a good deal to buy a house at $90,000. So to cut the story short, by the time we closed on the house, it appraised for $140,000. Nice. And I was so ecstatic. I'm like, oh, I just got $50,000 for free.
Yeah.
So that kind of opened my eyes. I'm like, wait a minute. It looks you can actually just get money without really working hard just by buying rightly. So that kind of got me interested into the real estate. So I knew the market in Nashville was going up because I was on Redfin every day and I saw the prices going up. So I got interested in buying real estate. And so when I was looking at real estate, I saw this big house, which was being sold in the neighborhood, and they said it had some tenants who are vets, and the owner was willing to sell and the grandfather in the tenants. So I said to myself, probably I should buy this house. So I went to look at it, and to cut the story short, I actually bought my first group home license. I did not have no license, had no experience. I just learned on the fly. And that's how I got into group homes.
That's the best way to learn. That's why we're always trying to encourage people to take action, right? Hey, you're going to learn along the way. You have us and the Gold Course to kind of help, but taking action is the best way to learn. In my opinion, that's the best way to learn pretty much everything.
But I made a lot of mistakes because I
Oh,
hadn't
yeah.
discovered you.
Well, hey, you can learn from other people's mistakes or you can learn from your own. But that's another way to learn as well, right? You know, fumble
Yes.
along the
Yeah,
way.
absolutely. Yes.
So let's rewind a little bit. So you kind of almost fell into real estate investing and then just kind of got into, saw a good deal and ended up becoming a group homeowner. What time period was this?
This is about 2018.
Okay.
So to cut the story short, so I'm given this licensed group home. We close on it. And actually, the owner had promised that if I was going to keep the tenants, that's when he was going to sell to me. So I promised the owner I was going to keep the tenants. But initially, I didn't know it was licensed. But then I came to realize it was licensed. So now I had to learn very, very quickly how to run a licensed home. I made a lot of mistakes.
It's a lot of rules.
Yes, a lot of rules. And I worked really hard because it was a 24-hour facility. So I was running this group home, which was 24-hour facility, just me and my husband. Thank God our W-2 schedules allowed it. So then I noticed that actually in this group home, first of all, it was very difficult for me to get the tenants. Because once the tenants who were there left, I didn't know what to do. But I noticed that in this group home, there were individuals who really didn't need the services. Like they were independent. So I was asking myself, but why are they living in a group home where they are supervised? So then I started to wonder, why are they being supervised when they are independent? There must be a way for us to separate those ones who need supervision and those ones who don't. So that's actually where the idea of independent living kind of clicked in my head, that maybe there's a way to separate these two groups.
And is that when you kind of started, you know, searching the internet and then
yes,
hold on
yes,
our
absolutely.
Stuff?
That's when I started searching the internet about how to run group homes. I didn't find much information, but when I found your website, that's when I realized, oh, so this is how to do it. So I bought that package. I think it was $179, and you opened my eyes. Yes, you're absolutely amazing.
The light bulb started to click, right?
Yes.
Why don't you explain to the folks out there who maybe they haven't really like gone through our content and it hasn't really clicked for them? Can you explain to them the difference between like a licensed facility and then kind of the business model that we typically teach people how to do?
Basically, a licensed facility, you have to be giving some services. So really, the licensing part comes when you give the services. But if you are not providing any services, then you do not need to be licensed. And that I learned also by searching your website and reading every material that you had. Because essentially, you're just a landlord. You're just only providing housing.
Bingo. That's it in a nutshell. And then with your current properties, are you, how many, is it still just the one licensed property? Do you still have that?
No. Actually, after I read your website every day, I realized I needed to transition. But let me go a little bit back.
Sure.
When I was running the licensed facility, it was very, very involving. It was just me and my husband really running it 24/7. So by good luck, he happened to have a job where he could go to work at 6 o'clock, come back by 8. So by that time, I would be taking care of the tenants, giving the meds. Then he would be at home from 8 to about 4 o'clock. Then I would go to my W-2 job. Then I'll come back around 4. Then he would go to his second shift. So it was really hard. We didn't have time to do anything. We worked really hard. And we did that for about 3 years. We couldn't visit our kids. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't go anywhere. We were really tired. My husband was suggesting we just close it down. But I told him, no, I think there should be another way to run this. People have been doing this for a long time. There should be another way. So when I stumbled on your group home model, I'm like, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. I want to free my time. I only want to provide housing. I do not want to provide any services. And that's when I aggressively decided that I'm going to transition my licensed home into an independent living home. And in 2021, in about October, I transitioned.
Excellent. What's the quality of life like compared, you know, running the independent living homes compared to the licensed facility?
A licensed facility, if you're an owner operator, it is work heavy because you have to do everything. But unlicensed facility, for the most part, you can just outsource. If there's anybody who needs any services, you outsource it. So you're essentially just a landlord. So you have your time back. You know, the biggest thing is that you have your time back. And also you can scale, because when you're a licensed, it's very difficult to scale. But your model is very amazing. You can scale. You can have up to 20, 15 homes, and you don't have to spend so much time. So I definitely advocate for the unlicensed if you plan to scale. But if you don't plan to scale, then probably the licensed route is the way to maybe make more money.
Yeah, definitely. There's advantages and disadvantages to each model, and I think you hit the nail on the head. With the licensed route, you can, per property, 100%, your revenues are going to be
off the charts.
Crazy. Yeah, they're all, exactly, off the charts, right? But people don't take into account the amount of work that comes along with it. And for a lot of people, like the work that to get it started, there's usually a lot of paperwork that goes through the licensing process and everything like that. I guess you were able to acquire that with the purchase, it sounds like.
Actually, I didn't have a license, but guess what? The state did not have any place to put this residence. So they just had to work with me.
Really?
They did not have a choice but to work with me. I land on the go with no license until I get the license. Because for the most part, they said don't know where to take this residence. They don't know.
And did you have experience in the field? Like, did you have medical experience prior to that?
No, zero. Zero medical experience.
And did you guys have employees, or you and your husband were doing it all?
We were doing it all. The reason we decided to do it for the most part is this. We did not want to get in trouble with the Department of Labor, because there is very strict rules with the Department of Labor regarding employees that you require to stay in a home, you know, for 24 hours. They pretty much want you to pay them for every hour. And if you do the math, it's like about $7,000 a month per employee, even at minimum wage. So we could not afford employees. So we did mostly by ourselves. Like I said, my husband would be doing it mostly during the day, and I would be doing it early morning and then late evening. And, you know, we actually moved into the group home basement. We moved into the group home basement just to make it a little bit easier on us. So the employee route, unless you're doing it yourself so that basically the labor laws don't apply, I would not advise it. Unless you've got enough residents to who actually pay more money. But most of the residents that we deal with do not have enough money to pay an employee $7,000. That's pretty much everything that you collect. So you can't spend it on an employee. You have mortgage, you have got bills. So that model is for people who want to be owner operators, the licensed one. It's not functional for people who do not want to be owner operators.
Yeah, and guys, if you're, you know, just new to our content, or you want to look into this further, if you go listen to a podcast, the gentleman's name is Yaz, Y-A-Z-Z. He's been doing the licensed route for almost a decade. Well, he retired now, but you get a really good inside glimpse on what life is like, you know, running licensed facilities. So let's kind of jump forward a little bit and kind of break it down for him. So Gladys, let's say right now you're not running the licensed facilities. Let's say you have a vet. He wants to live in one of your homes, but he is going to need, you know, let's say he's going to need a CNA on hand. How do you handle that now?
We absolutely afford every resident the right to bring in their services. And that is just like someone who is in their home. They have a right to bring in services that they want. But we are very clear that we don't provide services because we don't have license. So yes, we would allow them to bring services, and some of them have brought in services. But I ourselves don't provide services.
So the technical term we use for that, it's just simply outsourced, meaning...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yes.
Meaning that Gladys is not, she's not providing it. She's not dealing with, it's not like she has employees that are doing the services. And typically in practice, it sounds like all the services are already set up ahead of the time. by the time they come to your property. So
it's absolutely. Not- In fact, one of the things that we ask their residents, especially the ones whom we get from the hospital, are their services set up in a way that they can live in our home without depending on us? And if that is a yes, we get them in. If that is a no, they need help, we refer them to our homes that offer services. So we don't say no to anybody. We help them to identify the homes that are more appropriate for them.
Perfect. And it, totally choice. It sounds like you have a pretty, some solid referral sources, not really dealing with vacancies a lot. If you guys did want to go the extra mile, you could refer the people that are calling you to a caseworker or to a home health company or something like that.
Oh yeah, actually I do that all the time. I have got a whole spectrum of other different type of homes so that if mine doesn't fit, I call where I think they fit best and I tell them, hey, there's a client here, take them. I think they would be better a fit for your home. What about if you give them a bed? And actually most of them are very glad. Actually, I've been thinking maybe I should start a referral process because I have been referring a lot of residents into other homes who don't fit my model for free.
That is a whole other, you know, income stream if you wanted to set that up. But yeah, they're called referral agencies. Mm-hmm. So what Andy will do is he just establishes relationships like that. And, you know, he'll get referrals from other places sometimes and he refers as well. So yeah, totally optional. As you guys can see, once you learn the stuff, once you learn the ins and outs and the differences and the nuances, there are a ton of opportunities out there, guys. What we like to do is just kind of remove the confusion, like explain the differences, and then just kind of let you guys choose which path you want to take. So let's kind of rewind back to the path, right? So you had that first licensed facility. It was operating, but it was pretty much 24/7 job. It sounded like, how did you go about getting the next couple properties set up? And you touched on one of the struggles that you faced was after people moved out, hey, how do you find people, right? How do you find residents? So tell us a little bit about how you kind of tackled those next steps.
Yeah. So as far as the residents are concerned, yes, I struggled a little bit because I didn't know where to get the residents. So, I started Googling and I thank God I found you. So I learned like ways how to call the social workers, how to link up with them. And if I remember something that it still stands up to me to this day, I think you said that the money is in the follow-up. So I realized I wasn't following up. So I learned to follow up. Like if you make a phone call, you have to follow up until you get the resident to the house. So the group home Riches course really did a lot to teach me how to get the residents. But also, as I was running this licensed group home, like I said before, I learned that not everybody needs to live in a licensed home, an institution-like home. Because some of the residents were so independent, they knew what to do. They would almost tell you what you need to do if you're not sure what to do. Especially because I came in, I was inexperienced. Some of them were telling me, oh, so-and-so needs 1, 2, 3. So-and-so needs 1, 2, 3. Basically, they knew their medication. They could be independent. So I knew, actually, given a chance, they don't have to be supervised. They need to go in a different kind of house. And that's when I started thinking about separating the two. And also what I didn't mention, basically my path to going to independent homes, I remember one of the social workers asking me when he came for, not the social worker, but the inspection person from the licensure. One time he asked me that, what do I do when a resident is so independent and they are ready to go to the next step? Then I asked him, what are we supposed to do? I thought they're supposed to live here. Then he said, no, they're supposed to live here. You teach them independence. They're supposed to transition to the next step. So that kind of also caught me thinking, okay, so the aim of supportive living is to transition to the next step. But most people really don't transition. They stay because there's no other place to go. So it got me thinking that actually I need to maybe learn how to separate these two, those who are independent, and then put them in another house and then just run an independent living. So bottom line, I knew that actually there are people who are even in supportive living that do not even need to be there. They can be in, they can live independently. They have learned enough skills to be independent. And actually, that's when I actually knew that the independent living model is actually viable and you can do it and it will be more hands-off. And so when I saw your group home Richest Cause actually basically giving me a green light, I said, okay, this is it. I'm going to do it.
Well, there were so few people actually doing that model that you found people that could have lived in independent housing, but they were needing to go to licensed facilities.
Yes. That's... And there's a lot out there.
Yeah.
You know why? Because you'll be surprised. A lot of the licensure agencies don't advocate for this. They don't even tell you exactly the truth that if people are independent, they need to be separated because they want to make it, you believe that licensing really is the way to go.
Well, one of Andy's favorite, one of the many lines I've gotten from him is that there's a lot of money in confusion.
Yes, there's a lot of money in confusion. That is true. Yes.
And absolutely. Andy, I think we got Andy on the call. Andy, pop in if you'd like. Welcome, sir.
Yeah. Hey, guys. How are y'all doing today?
Excellent. We're doing good. How are you?
Good. Good. Thank you so much for coming on. That was awesome when we chatted with you on the webinar the other day. And we said, oh, we gotta get her on. This is fantastic.
Oh, yes. I think I'm pretty aggressive in finding out information about group homes.
You have to be.
Yeah. I actually love it because that's when you can be able to fight some of the local jurisdictions.
Andy, so we were learning her story. Gladys actually started out, she almost stumbled into this. She started out real estate investing. She found a good deal, but that deal was basically a licensed property that she took over. And then she realized that she purchased a 24/7 job.
So, oh my God. Gladys, where are you located?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay, cool. Well, you're in, it's like a little baby Austin. It's more or less from what I've heard. So,
yes, they are pretty aggressive in code enforcement, but we have.
Yeah, I think all of these cities that are really turning, like Nashville, certain places in the Carolinas, Austin, I hear that the code compliance departments are just the worst.
Yes, actually, they came after me a few months ago, and I just used the group home Rich's blueprint, and I was able to fend them off.
Wow, which that's very impressive, especially in a city like Nashville. Because
yes, you have to know your facts. You have to know your facts.
Yes, you've got so much happening in those areas, and the houses that used to be, 40, 50 grand are now probably 400,000.
Yes,
and so,
absolutely.
Yeah, they want to keep the tax base coming in.
Well, the issue is that the local people, they don't even know about the federal stuff. And Andy put together the group home, the gold course with just everything that worked for him, right? But that stuff is based on the federal code. So Gladys, what you just said, it's rare that we get emails or coaching clients that run into issues like that. But so far, everybody that's had an issue like that is very similar to Andy's story as well. It's like, hey, you just bring up the federal codes, you know your rights, and they typically they back off. So again,
you just ask them, where do you want these people to live?
That's a good
one. You want them to live? You want them to continue being under the bridges? Don't you think it's better for them to be in my house, which is very nice, very clean, very well maintained, nice neighborhood?
What did they say what were you violating? What was like the code that they said that you were violating?
Basically, a neighbor called and said, I'm running an illegal group home. So I said, okay, what's an illegal group home?
Yeah.
They're saying, maybe it's a boarding house. What's a boarding house? This is basically just a group of individuals who are disabled, who are living together. They can take care of themselves, just like any other family. Is that a problem? They're like, no, because a neighbor called. I'm like, well, federal law allows people who have disability to live up to 8 in a house, in a single family house. So initially they were very kind of aggressive, but when they saw actually I knew the kind of the rules, they kind of backed off and they told me they're going to make it possible that I can operate without being harassed. So they just told me to upgrade the electrical, to upgrade anything that looked that maybe it's a code violation, which I did pretty quick, fast, and efficient. Then I asked them, what next? Then they said, I think you're okay. And I said, okay, that's fine, but I've got more houses that I would like to, you know, to copy the same model. They said, then they told me what you do, just copy and paste what we have told you, and that's it.
Fantastic. I also think that that's something very interesting, how you respond, and I always recommend, and that's exactly what I do. Whatever they tell you to do, just get it done as quickly as possible.
As possible, efficiently, and even better.
Yeah, you get it done quickly, and then you get them off your back.
Yes.
And then once they know that you're complying and in some contexts, they tend to just start looking for issues elsewhere.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, they were really very excited because I told them, I want to make sure that every person in this city is housed. Is that a big problem for you? I thought I was solving your problem. So you should be helping me instead, not really listening to neighbors, knowing that there are federal laws that protect people with disability. Yeah, so it was kind of interesting. So I'm not expecting any problem because to me, it looks like now they gave me a ticket to basically scale up my independent group homes.
Unbelievable.
Andy, your experience was pretty similar to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they would, trying to think how long it took, you know, look, I wasn't as successful as many of our students, you know, Patrick, Orlando, and a number of the others, but I got a number of group homes up, you know, within the first year. And I'm trying to think when I started having issues with code compliance. It was, to be honest with you, I was probably on my 15th group home. Yeah, you know, and when we did try to keep it pretty quiet. I mean, so we would do things like build fences out front. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the guys, I don't know if it's the same for you, Gladys, but a lot of these guys, they like call to the smoke. They like to smoke their cigarettes, right?
Or call and, the police.
Yeah, yep, that as well. But what we would do is we'd build fences in front of the house, make sure that they could smoke inside those fences. That way the neighbors weren't necessarily seeing them. And then ideally we'd get them into the backyard so they could smoke back there or do, you know, drink their coffee or whatever. But yeah, code would come out and I would be, I wouldn't be incorrigible, but I would be, you know, I'd be relatively tough with them and I would make sure that they wrote everything down and I would try to videotape it. This is actually once we actually had like, we didn't even have iPhones and stuff back then. So mm-hmm. I would have like a regular video camera that I'd be trying to tape it on so that I could make sure that everything that they told me, mm-hmm. I in fact got done. And then, yeah, turn it around, get it done and get them off my case. But to Brandon's point, the main thing that I would always try to do is, you know, I would give them a copy of the federal guidelines. And that way they knew, okay, they, you know, realistically, they can't really shut me down or do anything.
They actually told me they've never shut anybody down.
They just want fines. You know, they want to keep themselves employed, right? Mm-hmm. So... My theory is that once they run into people that actually know their rights and know what they're talking about, okay, mm-hmm. they're going to look for little stuff that's against, you know, property code anyways. That's yes. why they give you, you know, the punch list, the stuff you need to fix. Mm-hmm. And then they're just going to go harass people whose, you know, grass is long. That's much easier than dealing with, you know, like a federal lawsuit and getting fined and things like that.
But Andy, what I wanted to say is that, really, the group home model is so great because when I began in 2018, I did not have no retirement. Well, I'm not a spring chicken. My kids are kind of all out of college. I had spent every dime to take them through school to make sure that they have got these good W-2 jobs. And thank God they have got good jobs. But myself, I had zero retirement. So that's also one of the things that drove me to really be aggressive about, you know, sticking out with the group homes. And as I'm talking, I think I may be in the multi-million dollar range for now, both with my business and the properties that I have acquired.
I mean, what an amazing, I wish that we could go back in and chop up that quote, because this is really what we're trying to do is empower people to not only make a difference in other people's lives, but really in their own lives. I mean, this is a business model yeah. that can completely catapult you through different.
Like now, honestly, if I want to retire now, I can.
Economic strategy.
I can.
It makes Brandon and I feel immensely happy and proud also. It's fantastic. Helping a lot of people, but you're also helping yourself financially.
Yeah. Super rewarding. You do good and do well, yes. So I would advise people, even who have W-2 jobs, even if they do it on the side, it's really worth it because, I mean, just say in a period of about 5 years, because I began in 2018 to now, I've been able to really feel comfortable to retire when I basically came from zero. I had zero network in 2018. Zero. Apart from my primary home, it really, there was nothing else, you know, I could fall on. So definitely group homes is the way to go. And especially group home richest model, it's fantastic.
Buddies, how many, and you guys probably already went over this, but I'm just jumping on a little late. How many properties do you have now?
For now, I've got seven single family homes and about seven doors, which I call them group home apartments, because even there, the families are sharing. The families are sharing in the apartments.
Yeah.
So because I have bought them very strategically using the money that I get from the group home, I've been reinvesting it back. They have almost a net worth, just the real estate, probably more than 2.5 million with the, together with the business, maybe about 3.5 million. And I feel like that's, it's enough for me to retire if I want to, but I'm going to keep on helping people.
Gladys, and you guys may have already gone over this as well, but where are you from originally? I noticed a little accent.
I am originally from Kenya.
Okay.
I grew up really, really poor. Yes, I grew up really, really poor. We barely had a place to live. And to me, even that's one of the motivations for, you know, trying to provide housing for people. Because when I grew up, we really had no house. We were living literally in a house, a little hut, which had holes inside. And I remember seeing people with nice houses, and I was just hoping that one day maybe I'll have a house. So to me, that really motivates me because I really know what it means to lack, you know, to have nothing.
I love hearing these stories. I do think, obviously, I was born in Houston, so I don't have, I call it the immigrant edge. I do think that there is, it's weird. I mean, a lot of people could say, oh, well, you know, it's tougher for the immigrants because you guys have just come here. But I think that the average immigrant comes over here to the United States with a real strong desire to improve their lives, the lives of their family and their family's future financially and every other means as well. But there's a different level of grit and determination.
Absolutely. Yes, like
with the immigrants than you do with, you know, the average person born here in the United States.
Yes, for the most part, yes. We normally say we normally don't have options. It's like do or die.
Yeah.
It's because if you have left everything behind, your relatives and everything, you really, if you cannot work hard, then what else are you doing? You just have to work hard. You don't have a choice.
Yeah, the Hernan Cortez burned the ships in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk to Brandon and I just about that experience, right? So you're from Kenya. Did you guys already talk about this or not really?
No. Oh.
Talk to us about that. So you're from Kenya. When did you come here to the US and like, what were your goals in coming here and all that?
I came to the US at the time. I came as a student.
Okay.
I was a student, but I had a family. I had a family of four children. And after being in the US for about a year, I became a single mother. So I raised my four children by myself. It was hard.
Yeah.
We lived on $100 a month, but we keeping on. We have never been on social security. We've never been on any food stamps. Just worked hard. And I told my kids, just keep on working hard. One day it's going to be okay.
Yep.
And even as I'm talking right now, I'm really proud of them because one of them is one of the higher, is actually one of the biggest investors in Nashville. Maybe that's another story. He has his own channel and he's actually a multi-billionaire at the age of 23. And I'm very proud of him. So we are an immigrant success story.
It's fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, I love hearing, you know, especially for people that were starting from zero, like yourself, really less than zero. And you come over here and you find this business model that works. You start helping out people, you start providing housing for people. And the next thing you know, you're at the point where you're at right now, where you feel like you could comfortably retire and everything else. It's It's awesome. It's absolutely awesome.
And all in 5 years' time.
I mean, 5 years is when I began investing, but I've been to in the United States for the last 21 years.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But I was going to school. I was a professional student.
Were you acquiring properties while you were in school as
no,
well?
No, I did not have the ability to acquire properties. At the time, I was a student on a visa. And you know, when you're on a visa, you're not allowed to do a lot of things until I got a chance to get off of the visa and go into permanent residency. There was no way. If you do it, you're violating the law. And I didn't want to do that. You know, I followed the law to the T, however hard it is. You just keep on following the law until, you know, one day when you get the privilege to transition from just being a student to a permanent resident, then you can work as hard as possible. So really, it's been about just 5 years since I got my residency. And that's when I began investing.
Yeah, I mean, this should be super inspirational for all the people listening. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So guys that are out there, again, she had her education, but she had put it all into the family. So she was essentially starting from zero. And in 5 years' time, it sounds like the net worth is well into the millions at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank God.
Unbelievable. So yeah, for the folks in our school group or emailing me, oh, I want to start, but you know, I can't get going. Like I need to have a ton of money first, or I need a government grant, or I need financing. No, you don't.
You just need to recognize the opportunities that exist in your environment and take advantage of it. And if you've got guidance like Group Home Riches, follow it to the T and you'll be okay. You'll be okay.
We love to hear it. And again, it's not just all about the money. Group Home Riches, the real riches are, you know, kind of what drew you to this. You heard Gladys say she wants to house everybody.
Because I grew up poor. We were really kind of houseless, maybe homeless. So it's a good thing. Even if it's just a room where you know that it's there, you go wherever you go and come back, it's there. It's really a peace of mind. And I truly believe, you know, housing is healthcare. Because a lot of people that we serve, really, sometimes they go to the hospital, not because they are sick, but because they want a place to go. They know once they reach the hospital, the social workers are going to help them identify a place to go.
We get that feedback a lot from the caseworkers and the nonprofits that we work with, where they're the ones that are really working side by side with these people and, you know, trying to get them back on their feet. And that's exactly what they say. They're like, how are you going to focus on, you know, getting a job or getting your family right when you don't even have a place to live? That's why they're so desperate. They're so desperate for people like Gladys that are willing and able to provide this type of housing.
Absolutely. And actually now I began doing in my group homes, those people who are willing to transition to the next step, maybe going to an apartment or buy a house, I help them. I direct them. I show them how to buy a house. If they're ready, I help them to identify a house and they can buy and, you know, move to the next stage. So far I've had one vet buy a house and I'm very proud of that. This month I have got someone transitioning into an apartment and, you know, we want to keep them there, but we know that given a chance, they want to go to, you know, maybe be more independent. So we help them to reach where they want to go if they're willing to do that.
Beautiful. And those are the real riches that I think Andy was talking about when he recreated this. He showed me, you know, just all the voicemails that you get and the letters from your previous house guests, Andy. But those are the real riches that we talk about. So Gladys, amazing story. I want everyone to kind of rewind that, marinate on it, especially if you're ready to send me a Debbie Downer email about how you can't get started. Just go listen to Gladys's story and stay positive minded. A lot of times I tell people, look, you're not ready for this. Like, you need to go read a book. Like, you need to get your mind right first. So
absolutely. You got to get your mind right. Yeah.
Gladys, was that something that you always had? Like, were you always like gung ho and like positive minded and, you know, believed in yourself, or
always,
that something you had to learn?
Always. I always believe in myself. I'm a go-getter. I just believe if you need something, just work hard, keep on, don't give up. And one way or another, you'll figure it out. But it's even better if you can be in a position where you can get help. It helps you to even be faster. For example, I would really recommend Group Home Riches because they basically give you a blueprint. So yeah, working hard is the thing I have always done. But getting into a mentorship, I would recommend for people who are starting off, they should get into a mentorship if they don't know how to do it by themselves. And they should just follow the guidelines and they'll be okay.
Boom. It's a shortcut to success.
Yes, it's a shortcut to success.
Gladys, go back to kind of your mental outlook. Is that something that you honed and crafted yourself and curated on your own? Or did your parents instill a lot of that belief in you? How did that all come about?
It's interesting. I grew up with, I would say, a little bit of a dysfunctional family. I would say it's almost like growing up with a father who was very alcoholic.
Good.
So I remember my mother one time telling me that, you know, you have to try everything you can to go to school. Otherwise, you're going to be somebody's maid. And so I actually believed verbatim what my mom told me. And I worked really, really hard because then I believed going to school really is the only way to, you know, come out of poverty. And for the most part, it was. And I've always really been just a hard worker, do what I need to do to go where I need to get.
Yeah, so it was something that your mom instilled in you, but it was probably somewhat of a gift that God had given you as well. So
yes, absolutely. Everything comes from God for sure. Because even just, for example, I am actually by training a physicist. So even a lot of things that are basically go into a home, there's a lot of physics and I really enjoy it. To me, it's like bringing my physics live, you know, like, you know, the electrical things and, you know, the plumbing things and AC things. I know all the theory as a physicist. So to me, I mean, a house, real estate is really where I see how it comes into function.
Yeah.
So I've always, you know, been mesmerized by physics. So to me, doing real estate is basically living how to be a physicist. That's how I've actually looked at it in different ways too.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's extremely interesting. Well, super inspiring story, guys. We're coming on like about that hour mark. This is kind of typically how it goes. We'll bring people on to talk about like a specific subject. Then their stories are just so inspiring that we get into that. So if you have like another, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes, Gladys, I'd love to talk about kind of like the marketing that you started doing, like the connections you had for referral sources. And then we talk about kind of the new going ons in the industry, like related to shared housing and the vouchers and things like that. Is that okay with you guys?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, excellent. Because we were talking about how when you transition from the licensed route, you learn how, okay, people are moving out, you're getting new properties. You need to find what we call referral sources, mm-hmm. right? So why don't you tell the people a little bit about that and how you establish those relationships, and then we'll talk about the new vouchers.
Basically, initially, I was not doing it efficiently. Like I said before, I tried looking for help from other group home operators. They were not really very forthcoming. But by getting your course and, you know, the way it was, you know, the way you teach people how to get the referral from the hospitals, from the homeless shelters. I pretty much followed that, you know. Now, when I bought the course, I followed it to the T. I would call the hospital, I would go to the shelters, call the nonprofits. And that's how I was able to basically get known in the community of people that interact on a daily basis with these people. Yeah. So basically, you have to be aggressive in calling the hospitals, calling the shelters, going there, giving your cards, and doing the follow-up. The money is in the follow-up. If you don't do any follow-up, more than likely, you won't get that tenant. So you have to aggressively market, but also do very good follow-up. And that's how I've been able to fill most of my rooms.
That's a key lesson there. And Andy, I'll let you kind of riff on that for a little bit. And right before you hopped on, she was saying that she was marketing, but then she learned the power of the follow-up. So
the follow-up, yes.
Yes.
Someone who's been in sales and marketing and real estate for, you know, pretty long time. Why don't you talk about that subject for a little bit?
the money is in the follow-up. The money's in the follow-up. That's where all, so I cut my teeth 25, a long time ago, right? Selling pots, pans, kitchen equipment, stuff like that. And interestingly enough, I mean, I feel like I've lost a lot of my sales ability just because my life has transitioned to a different stage at this point. However, I still know all the stuff. I'm not as good as it as I once was, but I do remember, and I still am a big advocate of this, the money's in the follow-up. And something that my boss taught me, you know, again, this is probably 30 years ago, is that 80% of sales occur after the fifth close. And so that's always stuck with me. 80% of sales occur after the fifth close. Mm-hmm. And so whether we're talking marketing or whether we're actually talking one-on-one sales, you need to get in front of the customer five times before you're going to be able to close them. So, and we talked about this a little bit on the podcast last week. Don't expect, if you're going to get married, don't expect to go out with your wife or your husband or your significant other the first time and then get married right away. It's just not the way things work. So you've got to get in front of people bare minimum five times before something's going to close. And frankly, like, look at all you folks that found Group Home Riches, right? I mean, you might have typed it into the internet and seen us on some blog or something like that, and maybe you opted in. Well, we've got a course, right? So we teach people, we send out a bunch of emails. You may not have even paid attention until like the fifth or sixth email.
Absolutely.
So 80% of sales occur after the fifth close. You got to get in front of those caseworkers, social workers, nurses, doctors, healthcare providers, 5, 6, 7, 8 times in order for them to eventually realize, hey, you know what? Yeah, I remember Andy. I remember Gladys. I remember Brandon or whomever. And then you got to market to them again until they actually give you a call.
Yes.
So that's my quick ripple.
Yeah. And that's the conservative number. I shared it in the school group after our webinar. We had a done for you client that we were marketing for. And you see there's a MOU attachment, which is just like a contract saying we're going to do business together. And you see that there were 44 email exchanges before that contract happened. So yeah, guys, don't get discouraged. You know, don't like make one phone call and then get discouraged if you don't get a contract. And again, think back to Andy, perfect example, the gold course. If anyone listening has the gold course, I will guarantee you that you did not purchase the gold course immediately. It's not like you saw one ad and then
no.
Yeah, Gladys is shaking.
No, I think
head.
I purchased it maybe after a year.
Yeah, you had to read our emails. Then you had to go listen to interviews like this. Oh, you know what? Maybe they're for real. Then you probably messaged us a question. Right?
Exactly.
And that's just human nature, guys. It's a marketing rule called the 7-touch rule, which in general, people, before they use a new product or new service, they have to be touched 7 times by maybe a phone call, email, marketing, in person. Those are all what we call marketing touches. Another just marketing kind of lesson that I've learned is a lot of people don't understand how big you need to go. And as Andy calls it, he calls it casting a wide net. So we're talking hundreds of contacts on an email list, for example, or Google ads to an entire city, right? Facebook market, but doing everything. And we're going to get a lot of questions about like the shared voucher program and, you know, hey, how do you do this? You'll find that when you do cast the wide net, that the opportunities kind of come to you. So that was my question to you, Gladys. Did you go like, did you contact the county first or the housing authority and figure out about the vouchers, or did someone reach out to you after seeing like other marketing or?
Actually, Brandon, I just came to know about the shared voucher recently. So when I knew about it, so I have not used it as yet, but I know it's a really possibility. So what my plan is to visit the Section 8 office and show them that hard document, because I have approached them before and they told me, oh no, we don't give any vouchers for group homes. So now that I know what I know, I plan to go back. And I believe most cities have not caught on, but if we push enough, we're going to start getting Section 8 vouchers in shared housing.
Yeah. And that document that you shared with us was actually from 2021. And we'd never heard of that either. Andy was pumped when he saw that. Andy, you want to talk? You want to the
point? Absolutely. Even me, I was surprised. That's actually...
It was incredible. I mean, you mentioned it, Gladys, and I'm like, oh my gosh, we have got to, number one, get our hands on that. Number two, get it out to all of our Gold Course members, just pretty much anybody that's on our list. Mm-hmm. But it's extremely exciting because...
And very powerful, like, because now we can get Section 8 money.
Absolutely. I mean, this is enormous where this is going to go. And, you know, the other thing that's really interesting about kind of life in general, you have these ideas. So things will start out as ideas and then they kind of eventually come into existence and they're very embryonic at the beginning. And it might take from the time you have an idea until the time that it's actually in existence. That could be a 5-year process, right? Mm-hmm. And then from the time it's in existence and it's like in the embryonic stage until it's a baby, might be another year or two. And then it takes another year or two before the thing can even walk. So again, we're looking at that document and it's from 2021. Well, for all intents and purposes, we are all at the forefront of this business.
Absolutely.
And it's, 2023 and we're just now hearing about it. And to your point, Gladys, most of these people over at the Section 8 offices, they don't even know about it.
No.
So now it's our job to go out there like you're about to do and go educate them. And that might take another couple of years, realistically, before they start really catching on and believing in it. And so, you know, for all we know, it really might not be until 2025 or 2026 until this is like mainstream.
Well, I think we can shorten that by, you know, trying to flash it in their eyes as often as possible and tell them, hey, look, this is hard.
And I think, Brandon, talk about the other day you had mentioned we're going to try to start doing that for a lot of the done for you clients.
Oh, yeah. We're going to take, again, guys, we're always trying to figure this stuff out as well. And it's, like I said, it's really all about casting a wide net, right? Mm-hmm. Talking to as many people as possible, developing these relationships. I mean, in theory, you don't need these vouchers to get referrals, but this is going to make it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're just going to take the keywords from that document. We're going to have our team punch it into Google. We're going to dig. We're going to call people. We're going to hound them. We're going to follow up with them. And yeah, we're going to start looking for those contacts in each city where we have a client. And again,
we're going to get those. They're the Housing Choice Voucher Program lists. We're going to get those and we're going to start reaching out on behalf of all of our clients and educating those Section 8 offices about the shared housing program.
100%.
Absolutely. I would love to be part of that because the more we educate, the more they're going to be knowledgeable, the more they're going to allow us to get some of that. Because actually, I had been rejecting choice voucher recipients before. But now if I come across one, I'm going to go right there and show them the document and tell them, no, they're allowed to have space in my group home just using the voucher.
Yeah. And we think things are slowly changing. So when we bring up the conversation with our contacts in these cities across the country about shared housing, you know, a lot of the nonprofits, they're kind of incentivized to do like single unit and single family vouchers and stuff, but we can still develop relationships with those folks and get referrals. And we've had a lot of people across the country say like, hey, they're lobbying people at HUD and, you know, government officials. They are trying to get more funding for shared housing, directly for shared housing. So that's exciting. And we're going to keep you guys updated as we learn. You guys will learn as well.
Absolutely. I would like to learn as much as possible. I love learning.
Gladys, I encourage you, if you're not in the school group.
I am.
Okay. Yeah. People are out there. Yeah, they're following up after that webinar and posting what they find. So another really cool, it's a private group for our Gold Course members. But yeah, there's thousands of people out there all learning this stuff and teaching each other. So we're excited about it.
If there's anything I can do to help any of your members, maybe the students, let me know.
Oh, they'll be asking you questions in there for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really inspiring. You know, there is a lot of nuance to this stuff. There are some technical things that you're going to learn with experience. But in general, it's a pretty simple business model. And it's all about, as we talked about previously, taking action, right? Like, you don't need to know the specifics of HUD vouchers and everything that we just talked about. There's a lot of stuff that you guys can do. And we've seen people literally within a few weeks, they get their referral sources. They start talking to landlords and they get started. It's not like you have to have the funds to purchase a property to get the.
There is plenty of people out there who are unhoused, plenty of people who need housing. And this is the thing, you know, most apartment buildings reject these people, but where do we expect them to live? They have to live somewhere. So we are basically doing a very good service and making sure that individuals who are rejected by everybody else, we're giving them a chance to be in a house.
Yeah. And a lot of it comes down to just education and misinformation out there. A lot of investors just don't know about this stuff. They hear vouchers and things like that, and they're completely turned off, right? They've heard so
absolutely. Much and some of them really, they're afraid of the so-called eviction. Is that your experience?
Well, Andy can talk on that. Talk about like the eviction process in your rental properties compared to the group homes, Andy.
Yeah. And I'm going to do that real quick and then I got to run. But just look, give or take, if you've got a regular rental property, you've got to go through the eviction process. Yep. Otherwise, I mean, you know, if you're running group homes, go lock the doors, bring their stuff outside, get rid of them. It's that simple. I mean, what would happen at a hotel? If Johnny Depp destroys a hotel,
yes,
he's gone, right?
Yes.
Well, the same concept at your place. And actually, if you look at the CDC guidelines, I mean, I should send something out on this again. But during COVID, when they came out with the eviction moratorium, it specifically said in there, it does not apply to shared housing.
Oh, it did?
Yeah. And it didn't say shared housing. It said, you know, congregant living or something like that. But the point is, or shelters. Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't apply versus a regular home. A lot of people... Obviously, you could always take the law into your own hand, but a lot of people, they were in a bad situation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I have nightmare stories, you know, secondhand and from our students.
But I've actually realized in the group home model, you can avoid evictions for the most part, especially if you go with the idea that you really don't want to evict them. Just want to, if they're not a good fit, you want to try help them to get to their next better housing choice.
Correct. And, you know, on that note, one thing that we've had a decent amount of success with over the years, and we still do it, but look, there's other operators in your town. There's other group home operators. Yes. There's other halfway home operators. There's other assisted living facilities that can find a way to bill Medicare for these people for who knows what. Call them up, and 9 times out of 10, they'll be more than happy to come on over and take those people.
Absolutely. So in that way, you really don't have to deal with evictions for the most part. Because if you approach it that, okay, if these are not a good fit, I'm going to help you. And you do help them. You find them where they are best suited. If they're on, say, on substance abuse, you refer them to, you know, to places where they can be detoxed. You basically even help them. You call and tell them, hey, this person needs some help. Would you take them?
Yep. Hey, Gladys, so nice meeting you, Brandon. Thank you for working with me and letting me jump on a little bit late. I got to run in here to this meeting. But yeah, fun chatting. I'm going to let you guys run and keep chatting.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Andy.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, I know it didn't feel like it, but we've gone well over an hour. Gladys, amazing story. Super inspirational. I know the people are going to take a lot from that. And we will continue, like we said, we'll continue learning together, like as far as the vouchers and stuff like that. Hopefully this does signify that it's going to be just more incentivized to do the shared housing model and more government funds available, because we feel it is the solution to the problem. Right. It's a way for it to be affordable for the people that need this housing, right? And the actual operators that are, you know, working with people that normally aren't qualified, and they're working with sometimes up to 8, 10, 12 people in a property, they are actually incentivized to do it this way. We don't need to get into the specifics, but you've heard the a glimpse of the type of financials that you can build up with this model in just a few short years. So Gladys, we'll definitely have to have you on when we learn more and as you scale. If you ever need help like with real estate stuff and scaling and everything like that, please reach out to us. And yeah, you guys, if you have any parting words for the people out there, let them know, and then let them know where they can find you.
Basically, if you want to operate group home, it's a really viable way to really earn a living and get and make some money and also make a difference in the people's lives. It's like a ministry. You can really do your ministry by serving these people whom everybody has given up on. So if you have a chance to set up a group home, do it. It's a really good thing to do. You do well and you do good. So people can find me on Facebook. I just use my name, Gladys Nangami, Gladys, G-L-A-D-Y-S, and Nangami, N-A-N-G-A-M-I-G. And you can also just Google Group Home Nashville. For people who are looking for a place to live, you can go online on Google, just Google Group Home Nashville, and there's a phone number there that you can call, and we'll be glad to give you a very wonderful house to live in.
Gladys, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to working with you and speaking with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Brandon. I appreciate you inviting me on your podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming. All right. Thank you. Have a great day, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.